From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Spot the old guy.
Sam Fender, who is this gentleman on his TikTok? Is it a wristwatch?
I may have had just my 50 minutes of fame, but wow, they were good minutes. Mm-hmm.
The HSC is saying they'll do it, and the HSC is all talk and they're no action, so I want to be Miss Action.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, how to sit the junior cert when you're 11, bringing pets to visit sick children in hospital, and what makes a one-hit wonder a one-hit wonder? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's desperately trying to cram for its introduction to podcasting entrance exam. Leaping straight into the newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show means we're starting with a four-day week. Great! Oh, hang on.
From four-day weeks to clocking off early, how workers are witnessing the end of 9-to-5. I think 9-to-5 is slowly becoming a thing of the past. That's what they're saying here this week. One of the big four, certainly in the UK, I think it is one of the big four accountancy firms, PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, announced it was reintroducing and extending summer working hours. They tried it last year. We spoke to Margaret Cox in Galway about this a few weeks ago. They're trying it all over Ireland as well. They're looking at six-month pilot programs, trialling the four-day working week across 60 firms in the UK, at least. I know they're looking at it here too. But, you know, some people aren't into it. They think, no, it's not working. It's not good for productivity. It doesn't work for us. Alan Sugar, you know, from The Apprentice, said, this is a bloody joke. The lazy gits make me sick. Call me old-fashioned, but all this work from home BS is a total joke. There's no way people work as hard or productively as when they had to turn up at a work location. Jacob Rees-Mogg said the same thing in the UK, government-wise. But there you're looking at, well, Jason Rees-Mogg is a young man trapped in the body of a Victorian, and Alan Sugar would certainly come from a certain work ethic and vintage, I suppose. It might feel differently to what a lot of the current influx of workers might be thinking. Anyway, back to PwC, one of a number of firms offering summer working hours. KPMG, another accountancy firm, offering 2.5 hours off a week during the summer last year. And they surveyed the staff, and shock, 90% of the turkeys said Christmas is a bad idea. 90% of the staff thought, this is a great idea. Summer policy hours, all summer. Yes, please, we'll have some of that. And 73% said it positively impacted their general well-being. It's got to be a good thing. I mean, if that's follow the science, follow the maths. Because that's the feeling there on all of that.
So, no four-day week for us because Ireland. Quelle surprise, as they say in Connemara. Anywho, let's fill our downtime with Downton.
I'll tell you what, I went to see Downton Abbey. Now, hold on. Now, enough with the judgment. I went to see Downton Abbey. I went on my own, which is one of my favourite things in the world to do, is go and see a film on my own. And I thought, okay, Operation Mincemeat is going to be on in half an hour and Downton Abbey's on now and I want to go now. Farouk Assault, I want it now. And I went to see it and I saw the previous movie. I couldn't tell you one thing about the previous, nothing. And I enjoyed it immensely. And I watched, I think, the first season of Downton Abbey and then it lost me. So I was worried I wouldn't know any of the characters or whatever. And then I realised as I sat there watching it, actually, do you know what? This is very beautiful. I'm loving these. The house is gorgeous. Look at the furniture, the writing desk, the clothes, the style. Lord Grantham and his tuxedo. And they're trying to, the plot, it's thin, but the bottom line is they want to make a movie in Downton Abbey. And Lord Grantham's nerves are gone. He's got all this business of kinema. He calls it kinema. I can't imagine actors around the place poking and looking at our things. So it's all very telling and knowing. And sure enough, the star of it is a young woman who's got a very thick Cockney accent because it's a silent movie. And this reflects what happened in the real day, because then they realised, no, we need talking movies. What are we going to do? And then out of the stage left comes the elegant and exquisite, because she is that as an actress and as a character, Lady Mary. Michelle Dockery comes out, does her thing. Well, Lady Mary, what do you want to use? Yeah, I love my Lady Mary. Kind of, anyway. Out she comes and she does the voice. And then the Cockney kind of just remains the face. And anyway, it was like looking, and then they go and play tennis in France, in the south of France, and they're whites, and it's all very F. Scott Fitzgerald, and it's quite something to look at. And Alan Leach is our Irish representative on the cast too, excellent as always. Maggie Smith, who is filming in Ireland somewhere at the moment, and no doubt she's listening. Welcome, Maggie. But she's superlative in it, actually. And it was gorgeous. I disappeared to another time, another place where I probably belong. You know, I'm not meant to be here at all. I'm a monochrome guy in a Technicolor world, but I belong back then. I'm sure of it. But I quite liked it. So that's what I'll say to you. Downton Abbey, I know a lot of people were saying, well, you're just, well, yeah, you ought to. But it just, I liked it. And then when I was there, two things happened. Apart from that, there was me and probably about four people, other people, which is a pity because cinema is such a great experience. The trailer came on for the new Elvis film, the Baz Luhrmann Elvis film, and it's a slightly longer trailer than I expected. And it looks spectacular. I mean, it covers everything, including Elvis singing Unchained Melody at the very end in the Vegas years, and I cannot wait to see it. And Elvis's daughter, Lisa Marie Presley, went to see a showing of this film. And here, the reviews are in. "It is nothing short of spectacular," said Lisa Marie Presley. "And absolutely exquisite. And the guy playing Elvis, Austin Butler, channeled and embodied my father's heart and soul beautifully," adding, "In my humble opinion, his performance is unprecedented and finally done accurately and respectfully. And if he doesn't get an Oscar for this, I will eat my own foot." I cannot wait to see that as an Elvis fan. That's very exciting. And then this ad came up where in the cinema where a dinosaur, have you seen this ad? A dinosaur is addressing the United Nations. Yeah, I thought it was a trailer for Jurassic Park, but it's actually an ad. And I looked and checked at the end of it. The ad is from the United Nations, who have commissioned this ad where the dinosaur is addressing the members of the UN and saying, don't let history repeat itself. The planet is about to go, it could be extinct if you're not careful. So that was the message, prevent extinction. I actually thought then they were talking about cinema, but no, they were talking about the planet Earth.
Ryan's Adventures in Cinema, bringing the musing to this morning's newsings. But enough of my yakking.
Gosh, TikTok, the enormity of TikTok continues to astonish. And at the Cannes Film Festival, they've partnered with TikTok. And so as well as Anthony Hopkins and Idris Elba, they've actively encouraged the big TikTok stars because they're bigger than TV and to some extent cinema stars, some of these creators. And I was only asking today, the guy who came second in the Eurovision, Sam Fender, and I was thinking, so who or what... Sam Ryder, sorry, got the wrong friend. Sam Ryder, spot the old guy.
Sam Fender, who is this gentleman on his TikTok? Is it a wristwatch?
Anyway, Sam Ryder came second, and I said, who is he? He was just saw a picture of the paper. And they told me, because in fairness, they were on top of it all, and said, yeah, he's a TikTok superstar who sings in sort of high voice and covers, and then became the Eurovision representative for the UK and came second. Amazing. He would have won it, I would think, if the Ukraine situation hadn't overtaken it, and rightly so. But anyway, TikTok stars taking over the red carpet in the Cannes Film Festival.
You know, I'm all for that, if it means we'll get more of Ryan's old man character. Now to finish up, let's hear Ryan bringing the news to this morning's newsings.
The replacement theory, that's a dark story, but it's that horrible story about the 18-year-old suspect who allegedly shot and killed 10 people at a supermarket on Saturday in the heart of a black community in Buffalo, in New York, appears to have been motivated by this racist far-right conspiracy theory that has increasingly found footing in mainstream US politics. This is replacement theory, but I think it's a French expression in the sense that it became known, originated in the French nationalist movement of the 1900s. And this, the alleged suspect here posted a 180-page document on the internet fixated on the notion of replacement theory, which is the notion that people from minority populations here and in the States and in Europe are replacing the existing white, largely Christian population. And the theory was embraced by far-right white nationalist groups globally, has inspired targeted mass killings, as you know, because the post that they're looking at that the guy put up includes references to other mass shooters who were motivated by racist ideology. And as we were listening to that, myself and my youngest were listening to a piece about this in the car yesterday. We were both shaking our heads going, how has this like whole grisly world of anti-Semitism and outright racism become such a thing again? You would, every, maybe it's the utopian hopeful optimist in one that says, well, we learn now that we can't be doing that, and that we can't be doing that, and that's why we're going to become evolved and a brilliant species. We're getting worse. That's a bleak assessment, but it's not pretty what's happening in the world, and that was a horrible situation. But these philosophies are propagated, and you know, as we're listening to a report about the Philippines at the weekend, and this their most likely incoming president Bongbong, as he's called, the Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., and the absolute lies being peddled online so cleverly, quote unquote, it just makes me so nervous about what I read and what I see and what I believe anywhere.
It's a tough one, all right. And a bit of a bleak place to leave this morning's musings on the news. But hey, it's a bleak world. Just ask that dinosaur. On Mondays Today with Claire Byrne, the lack of properties to rent was discussed. There were just 850 available nationwide, and that compared to an average of 9,000 in 2010. This morning, Owen O'Brien of Sinn Féin joined Claire to talk about a bill he's introducing to try to free up short-term lets for the long-term rental market.
We know people will remember that there was legislation introduced by the former housing minister Owen Murphy back in 2019, and this clamped down on letting platforms who were hiving off accommodation in areas where there was a lack of long-term lets available. But you say it's not being enforced properly, is that right?
Absolutely. So Owen Murphy introduced the short-term letting regulations in the middle of 2019 on foot of a unanimous set of recommendations in a report by our own Oireachtas Housing Committee. Essentially, if you're letting out your own property for less than 90 days a year, you don't need planning permission. You just need a letter of exemption from your local authority. But if you're letting out your own home for more than 90 days a year or an entire separate property, you need to apply for a change of use planning permission in a rent pressure zone. Now, one of the things the Oireachtas Committee said in advance of Owen Murphy's legislation was, if it was just left to local authority planning departments, who are already understaffed and heavily constrained, it would be difficult to enforce what were broadly an acceptable set of regulations to all parties in the Dáil. Back then, we called for a secondary level of enforcement, whereby any estate agent or any short-term letting platform like Airbnb who advertises a property that doesn't either have the exemption letter or the change of use planning permission would be issued with spot fines daily. Owen Murphy said he was open to it, but he couldn't get agreement at Cabinet. Dara O'Brien has subsequently said he's open to looking at it. But again, if you listen to your show yesterday, if you look at the figures that are in the Times Ireland edition today, like in Dublin City yesterday, there was 2,704 short-term lets listed on Airbnb, but only 436 rental properties on Daft. And what that means is platforms like Airbnb or other estate agents are making money from advertising properties that are not legally compliant with planning law. They're making profit from facilitating other people's law breaking. And that's not acceptable anyway, but it's certainly not acceptable in a rental crisis.
And how can you say that they're doing that? How can you be so sure?
Well, because figures we have from a number of local authorities, for example, from Dublin City as of early this year, show that the number of planning applications for properties to get permission, for example, to short-term let has only been about 20 to date and 6 retention applications. And that's out of, you know, the 2,704. Yes, they've had about 422 exemptions. But the overwhelming majority of properties that are listed today on Airbnb don't have either an exemption or a planning permission.
But they may not need one if they're under a certain number of days per year on offer for short-term let.
They still have to have the exemption. So the way this works is, and this was a good innovation of the regulations, if I have a property and if I'm just a peer-to-peer home share and I let my property out for less than 90 days, I just write to the local authority informing them that, and they give me a letter certifying that I have that exemption from the planning rules. And this would be really simple, because when a host signs up for Airbnb, Airbnb should just ask them, can we have a copy of your exemption, or your planning permission. And let's say they have the exemption. Well, Airbnb could then track at the point at which they pass the 90 days and then ask them for their planning permission. So it wouldn't require any additional level of bureaucracy or cost to the host. It would be very easy for Airbnb to administer. The problem is, if we introduced the legislation that I'm proposing to give the minister powers to set these spot fines, it would clean up the unregulated and illegal short-term lets. And clearly there's companies who don't want to do that because it's not in their financial interests.
Well, we asked Airbnb for a statement and we got one from the head of public policy for the company, Derek Nolan, in Ireland. And he says, the typical entire home listing on Airbnb in Ireland is already someone's home and is let for just 40 nights a year. Airbnb takes housing concerns seriously and supports a balanced way forward that addresses community concerns and protects the ability of everyday Irish families to benefit directly from the tourism economy. We stand ready to work with government, hosts and the broader tourism industry to get that balance right. But you're saying that in the rent pressure zones, regardless of the number of nights that you're renting your property out for, you should have the exemption.
Absolutely. So if it's 90 days or less, you have an exemption document. If it's 90 days or more, then you have to have planning permission. And I'll say this, Airbnb resisted the introduction of the regulations tooth and nail. And in fact, in my view, delayed the process when Simon Coveney was minister before Owen Murphy then introduced the regulations. They have been at the centre of controversies in almost every major city where unregulated short-term letting has been a problem. And look, we're not talking about kind of peer-to-peer home shares who are just making a few extra quid. That's fine and that's provided for. You go around Dublin today and there are very, very large commercial companies who have bought up significant properties, transformed them into short-term letting, do not have planning permission, and both they and the letting platforms advertising them, particularly since the lifting of the COVID-19 restrictions, are making money while operating outside the law. Mm-hmm. That is not acceptable. And to go back to the figures you quoted on your show yesterday, we've 12 or 13,000 short-term lets advertised across the state. We've only about 800 rental properties. Not all of those short-term lets are in pressure zones. Many of them are in tourist destinations and out in the countryside, and that's fine. But we have to have a better balance. And planning law is planning law. If you need planning permission to do something, you should have that. And Airbnb and other platforms and estate agents should insist on seeing that documentation before they allow anything to be advertised on their site.
That's Sinn Féin's Eoin O'Brien talking to Clare Byrne this morning about his attempts to prevent short-term lets crowding out the long-term rental market. The amazing Cara Darmody joined Ray Darcy this afternoon to talk about sitting the Junior Cert maths exam in fifth class, that's primary school, as a way of fundraising for services for her two brothers. Before talking to Cara, Ray read out her introduction to herself on her GoFundMe page.
Hi, my name is Cara Darmody. I'm 11 years old. I'm in fifth class in Ard Finnan National School. I have two younger brothers, Neil and John, who are both non-verbal with autism. They attend Scoil Cormac Special School in Cashel. Our family are friends with so many other families that cannot get services such as speech and language, OT, play therapy and psychology. It really annoys me that nobody is doing anything about it. These kids are at a disadvantage due to the lack of services. So I want to do something about it. I want to raise money to give everyone the same chance. We need the money to help right now. So as I love maths, I decided last September to study the whole 3-year secondary school junior cycle ordinary level curriculum in maths. That's a mouthful, Cara. And I've done it in 8 months with the help of my school and my parents. Thanks to everyone. I'm now going to attempt to sit the junior cycle maths paper on June 10th, 2022, with all money received to be split equally between the two schools. I really hope you can donate and help. I really need your help with this project. Thank you so much, your friend, Cara, which also means friend, doesn't it? Your name means friend.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, Cara Darmody is in with us in studio, and so too is her dad, Mark. Good afternoon, and thanks
so
much.
Good afternoon, Ray. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Well, that's amazing. We've told your story already, but we want to find out a lot more about you and your brothers and your family life. So, day off today?
Yeah.
What's the name of the school?
I go to Ard Finnan National School.
And you're in fifth, as we find out already.
Yeah.
And you're 11.
Yeah.
And you like maths?
Yeah, I do. I love maths.
Yeah. When did you discover that you liked maths?
It was when the lockdown hit that I realised that I was really strong at maths and that I could push ahead and I could do something special, and that since and that I could use my knowledge of maths to my advantage, and it's brought me here to the RTE place today.
Yeah, it has, and this is something special, as we've laid out there, is that you're fundraising to help services for people and families with autism.
Yes.
Yes. Now, tell me about your two brothers, what their names and their ages.
Well, my brothers are, I have two brothers and they're Neil and John, and Neil is 9 and John is 5, and they're both severely autistic and nonverbal, which basically means they can't talk and like they don't understand comprehension. And the reason why, one of the reasons why I'm doing the fundraiser is because like kids like Neil, like it's like, it's like he's like 9, he's 9 years old, but it's like he's like, it's like he's in, he has like a 9 months old brain trapped in a 9 year old's body, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And does he get angry, do you think?
Yeah, he often has these meltdowns, and I always get like frustration, not with them, but I get frustration that like if the HSE was giving them these services, that like they wouldn't be having the same meltdowns. Mm. The meltdowns would be a lot less violent. Like he often whacks himself on the head and bites his finger and all that.
How do you feel when you see that, Cara?
It makes me feel like very like upset, but also very like frustrated, like at the HSE that like they're not doing anything about this, because the HSE is saying they'll do it, and the HSE is all talk and there's no action. So I want to be misaction.
You're misaction, right?
Yes.
So you're taking it into your own hands and you're doing this. This is amazing. I'm going to say this again because people may have missed it. So you're 11, right?
Yes.
And you're taking on Junior Cert Maths.
Yes.
Okay. So this is something you shouldn't be doing for the next, what, do the maths on it,
four years.
4 years, yeah, there you go, yes.
Yeah.
Wow, that's brilliant. Has it ever been done before?
No, it hasn't.
This is, you're the first, so you'll be the youngest person to ever take a Junior Cert Maths paper.
Yeah, like the youngest person to ever like officially take the paper, yeah.
Yes, right, yeah. Right, okay. Mark, was this all Cara's idea, and how did you feel?
Yeah,
and
Noel, your wife. Ray, I don't know if I need to add anything there to it. Yeah, I suppose I was having a cup of tea one September day, and she came in and she said, Daddy, she said, in the way that she talks like that, and she said, I'm after coming up with a great idea. And she said, I'm going to raise money. And she was basically telling what she was saying. But then she said, I'm going to sit the Junior Cert Maths. Now, I was waiting for her to say, I'm going washing cars, or yeah, I'm going to throw a few footballs or something. And my jaw just hit the ground. Like, I literally could have done with CPR. But she said to me then, I said to her, but pal, I said, the school probably won't be able to cater for this. Oh, no, Daddy, that's the best news. You will be teaching me as well. So then I'm thrown into it. So look, fast forward 8 months. Here we are. She's ready to go.
Ready to go.
Ready to
yeah,
go.
I'm
yeah,
I'm ready to go.
The remarkable Cara Darmody and her dad, Mark, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. On this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show, Ryan spoke with Evelyn Neary, saying first off that they had previous, and he asked her to tell us how they had first met.
Do you mind sharing that story with everyone?
Yeah.
If you don't mind.
So we first met you, Ryan, when you visited St. John's Ward in the summer of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, Cian was in a hospital undergoing treatment for lymphoma. And he, I think it was around August time, if I'm correct, and he was after being in hospital on a full-time basis since about middle of June.
Yep, and he was there with your other son, his brother?
That's right, Shane, yes.
And his dad. And how was he then?
So at that stage, I suppose he was towards the end of his year of illness. And that year had been very much a roller coaster. He, had improved, then got sick again, had improved, got sick again. And then in June 2019, things were going really well. Cian ultimately needed a bone marrow transplant. So he was on the road to bone marrow transplant. Things were looking good. But unfortunately, he became very ill. And at that point, he was undergoing treatment, but he had relapsed. And I suppose when you're there in the middle of it, you don't see how bad it is. You just want to keep hoping and praying that it'll get better. But when I look back now, it probably was. The outlook was probably pretty bleak at that stage. Yeah.
In the middle of all of that darkness, what brought the light?
So in the middle of all that darkness, the light was brought by a four-legged friend called Cooper. So Cooper was Kian's golden Labrador. He had come into our lives at a very early stages of Kian's diagnosis. And when Kian was diagnosed first in September 2018, really after that point, he never returned to school or sport. Mm-hmm. While he was pretty well, you know, a lot of his time was hospital appointments and hospital stays. So he got Cooper at that stage. So as you can imagine, he was at home. He had this puppy full of fun. He was training him, walking him, and all of that. So the bond really strengthened. So you can imagine then when it rolled around to June 2019 and he became very sick again and had to pretty much stay in Dublin all the time, he began to miss Cooper. But going back to the joy that brought, I mean, the visits over and back to the hospital and the time spent with Cooper were really, really good for him.
And how did you navigate Cooper and the hospital and Kian physically? Because obviously the dog wasn't allowed into the hospital.
Yeah, so I suppose we did that in two ways. First of all, we got Cooper to Dublin. We live in Longford. So we got Cooper to Dublin and Cooper was kennelled nearby the hospital. And Kian was up and about most days. And so the first thing we did was we'd visit him at the kennels. So this became part of the daily routine. I mean, the consultants would come around in the morning and, you know, the daily plan always had to include the visit. So it was a case of working around that. But it worked pretty well. And then on one or two occasions, we brought Cooper just over to the back of the hospital, to the little courtyard there at the back of St. John's Ward. So Keane was able to spend time with him there.
Okay. And can you give me a sense of what Cooper was doing for Keane's heart?
I suppose when you're in a situation like that, you know, if you think about it, he was 15 years old. He was obviously a teenager, real sociable, you know, young man, loved eating, drinking, fine food, you know, out and about all the time. And then suddenly you're in hospital all the time. Now, the hospital are fantastic and they do so many things, you know, to enhance the daily routines for the kids there. But I think what Cooper brought was a bit of normality. So it was normal to play with your dog, normal to walk your dog. You know, just something to get up for and get dressed for that wasn't the medical related. And then even just for us as a family, the photos of them, you know, I can imagine a teenager didn't want a photo taken too often, but when Cooper was in them, it was a little bit easier. So just the photos, the fun, the distraction, the joy, it's just fantastic. They had this amazing bond, and even some of the photos, it's like, you know, it's almost saying, I love you, no, I love you more. You know, his face lit up, and Cooper's response, you know, just showed how much the feeling was mutual as well.
Kian lost his battle.
He did, sadly, Ryan, shortly probably after you met him, in the early hours of the 23rd of September. 2019.
I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry. I'm to hear that. There isn't a heart unbroken to hear such a horrible scenario.
Yeah.
You know, and how is it a crass thing to ask? How have you been, or like, what do you do with that? Let me ask you that. How do you process such a calamity, a catastrophe?
Oh, I don't know, Ryan. Like, it's still very surreal. It's almost 3 years, but there's still a part of me that just doesn't believe it happened. You know. I remember, you know, towards the end when it became a possibility that might lose him, I remember saying, there's no way I'll be able to go on without him. I just won't be able to go on without me. Like him and Shane, the light of, and my husband, and, you know, they were the light of our lives. So I don't know how to answer that question. You go on because you have to go on, and you just take one day at a time, and everybody's different and there's no roadmap. So I could say, yeah, we're doing okay, but sometimes I'm not so sure about that.
It's so. You know, like you say, it's a few years, but it's yesterday.
It's yesterday, and it's it's, you know, somebody once said to me, you lose the past, but you also lose the future. Like, Cian would be doing his leaving cert. He would have been 18 on Easter Monday. Mm. He'd be doing his leaving cert. All his peers, you know, are going into fine young men and his friends. And it's difficult. Everything is a reminder of what should have been and what can't be. Yeah.
But with all of that, what you can do is keep his story alive, can't you? And you can talk about legacy, and you know what keeps you going in some ways is why we're here this morning, among the reasons we're here this morning. And it's all related to dogs, and it's more importantly all related to Cian. Mm-hmm. And you wrote to, I have an email that you sent to us here on the 23rd of January 2020.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said you have a plan. And I remember reading it going, I met this person, and I think if anyone's going to get this off the ground, it'll be her, because I got that sense from you. But at the same time, I thought, no, now we're heading into a pandemic. Good luck with that. Could you think of anything more difficult, et cetera, et cetera? Today is a very bright day, I think, Evelyn, for you and for your family and for Cian's memory.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you tell everyone why that is?
Okay, so the plan, the crazy plan at the time was to, I suppose in a very simple way, recreate what was done for Cian and for Cooper, just in a more, I suppose, structured, safe, organised way. So we did it and it all worked out fine and it was great. But we wanted to, I suppose, based on my own experience in the ward, something that would be easy, something that would be free, something that would be efficient, and all of that. So the idea for Cian's Kennels was born from that. And as you said, we very quickly hit pandemic time.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, looking back, while it slowed us down, it gave us a chance to make sure we had everything ready. So we're a registered charity, so we had all that paperwork to do. We have a board of directors. So it gave us, in hindsight, it slowed us down, you know, gave us time to think it through, gave us time to look at all the regulations that we were looking at. So we spent the last 2 years really in preparation and liaising with the hospital and getting set up. And then on the 10th of January of this year, we cut the ribbon into an area at the back of St. John's Ward for where we would be building the kennels, Cian's kennels.
Okay.
And I'm delighted to say that on Friday, this week, this Friday, 20th of May, we will be officially opening the Cian's Kennels.
Congratulations, Evelyn. Yeah. This is, I'm so happy to hear this. The Cian's Kennels, can you paint a picture for us? What if we were to look out the window, what are we seeing?
Yeah, so if you look out the window now, so you're in St. John's Ward,
yes.
Around yourself. So if you look out the back window, so you're kind of looking out if you look out the window around McDonald House Beach, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an area there of land, and we have, with the huge support of a lot of builders and sponsors and all that, I'll come back to those in a second, that whole area has been enhanced. It's been tarmacked right in there. And then we placed a modular structure on the site there that contains, as you look at it, as you walk into it, a recreational area for the families just to sit and spend time together, bathroom facilities, and then also an indoor and outdoor area for the family pets to stay while they're visiting.
Wonderful. So there's just that sense of being able to go out to the dog, or I can't just say your dog, your friend, and, you know, commune in a way that Cian did with Cooper.
Yes, in the exact spot, Ryan.
In the very spot.
Yeah, I have a photo of Cooper at the hospital with Cian, and Cooper's tied to a fence, and literally behind him you can see the area where we now have put the visiting unit. So it's unbelievable. Really.
What does this do for you? How do you feel about this?
I suppose for me, I find I've compartmentalised the situation, and I suppose in one half I have Cian's loss that we have to deal with every day, and in the other half I have Cian's kennels. And for me, it's the joy. I feel like he's still with us in that and through that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been hugely therapeutic for me. And people often say, you know, all the benefits we will bring to children and their families. I think, you know, it's given so much back already.
Evelyn Neary telling the extraordinary story of the loss of her son, Cian, and the initiative that arose from that, Cian's Kennels, on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. Resilience Tested is the title of a new report from the Children's Ombudsman, Dr. Niall Muldoon. It details, among other things, a 79% increase in complaints for 2021. Muldoon spoke this morning to Claire Byrne.
As you said, we've got a huge increase, nearly 80% increase in complaints. And I think what it highlights to us is that we've kept using the word resilient for children over the last 2 years. And I think it's very unfair and misleading. I think essentially our children have been damaged by this COVID pandemic and by the impact of it throughout in many different ways. The education system is probably the most obvious one, where we got 53% of our complaints. You know, so they lost out on opportunities to make friends, to change friends, to be involved in sporting and drama, all those areas. They also lost out on opportunities with families and friends outside of school, where they didn't get a chance to grow and to mature. They may have lost loved ones through the pandemic that they didn't get a proper usual funeral and bereavement process. So the children that we are seeing over the last 2 years are certainly going to feel an impact over many, many years to come. And it's the increase, I think it's something like a 30% increase in referrals to mental health services at the moment in that area. So we are going to have to look at this and see how we can adjust and help them to come back to their best selves in the future.
Now, your report says that education is the subject of most complaints, and a sizable proportion of that, 10% of those, refer to bullying, how bullying issues are handled, bullying not being adequately identified and acted upon. Is it that the schools are not managing to tackle the problem effectively?
I think there's a range of issues happening now. I think the current policy for anti-bullying policy for schools was created in 2013, and things have changed so enormously in that time, Claire. Things like cyberbullying weren't a big issue. Things like homophobia or transphobia, or even issues like consent and sexually inappropriate behaviour weren't mentioned in the anti-bullying policies. So schools are now a microcosm of society, and things are changing and activities are changing. The type of bullying is changing. Online is growing more and more. Physical is not as much. Ignoring people is becoming a really strong form of bullying. So I think currently the Department of Education are reviewing their anti-bullying policies, and we'll be feeding into that next week. And from our experience with the complaints we get, schools are grappling with trying to name and deal with a lot of those issues. So some schools find it difficult to call it bullying.
But it's an incredibly difficult subject for a school to deal with, isn't it?
Absolutely correct. And again, as I say, I think it's become much more subtle as well. You know, one of the things we've asked for a number of years now is that the Department of Education would gather the information on bullying throughout the country, rather than just acknowledge that every school has an anti-bullying policy. They would find out what was happened in that year in every school about bullying, how many cases there were, how it was handled, and what they were designated as. So, I mean, is it racism? Is it sectarianism? Is it homophobia? Is it sexual contact? Those things need to be known. And once we have that data, we can start to help the teachers and the principals to really understand how to cope with it better.
People won't be surprised to hear that there are parents of children with special educational needs who really, really struggle getting the right and appropriate school place in their local area. So this is just down to luck, is it? It's where you're born and where you live. That's really the criteria that will decide whether you get the place that you need for your child.
Yeah, certainly. It's from our point of view, we've been very frustrated by the lack of places that have been made available for children with special education needs. You can see it in a number of areas around the country, Dublin 15, South Dublin, Cork, and various other areas have pressure zones, so to speak. But it's from our point of view, there's a lot of these things are predictable. We know who the children are going to be. We know what spaces are needed for them. There should be some degree of forward planning that prevents this having to become an issue. We have a huge number issue now coming forward into secondary school, where a lot of the children who went into the original special needs classes are coming through to second level in the next year or two, and there isn't enough places for them there. And that's why we've initiated a report that we're going to hopefully publish in the next month or two into school places and forward planning, because it seems to be less than adequate. We now have a legislation which allows the minister to designate a school to take children, but we shouldn't have to get to that stage. I mean, with all the information from the census and from Department of Education themselves and from parents feeding in, we should be able to plan so these children don't have to go outside of their area to get the access to education that they deserve. Because being in the local area is how they integrate, it's how they become part of the community, and it's how they thrive.
Mm-hmm. What's your greatest concern expressed in this report when you look back at 2021 and the complaints in a whole, the investigations that you carried out? What are you most worried about, Niall?
I suppose I'm still concerned, Claire, that as a state and as a public set of public bodies, we don't put the best interests of children to the fore in our thinking. You know, many of the decisions are made based on what we can afford, what the resources are, and where we're coming from as a system, and the children are being left behind. And you'll see that through a number of the case studies that, you know, a little bit of forward thinking, a little bit of thinking on behalf of what the child actually needs in this situation could have changed their lives completely. I think we don't have enough of that. We created a thing called the Child Rights Impact Assessment. We carried it out last year as well. And that's something we're pushing the government to try and do more often, is that ahead of any decision, whether it's on finance or budgeting or purchasing or policies, that they look at it and say, what is the impact on children in regards to this decision? And then you start to think in a different way. You start to preempt these things and prevent some of the issues these poor children are going through. So I think we need to step up in that regard. The other piece that would help there would be an incorporation into law of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which again would insist that every decision made by government and public bodies would have to think of the child's best interests. We need to move closer to that as quick as possible.
Dr. Niall Muldoon, the Ombudsman for Children, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about his annual report for 2021 entitled Resilience Tested. Now, Jonathan Smith got in touch with Liveline because of his brother William. He told Katie Hannan William's story on this afternoon's programme.
William noticed an irritation in his throat a couple of years ago at the start of COVID, and with all the hoo-ha in the hospital, it was difficult to get appointments completed.
And yeah, this was at the early days of COVID.
Yes. And at the earlier part of last summer of last year, the tests on his neck started to gain momentum, and they noticed that in fact he had a tumour in front of his larynx. And they opted. Now, the hospital were brilliant. Vincent were brilliant. Luke's were brilliant. And I respect them greatly. They started treatment sometime in around September for 7 weeks to try and nullify this tumour. But it's been to no avail. And it didn't work.
So how is he now?
He's stable now. He's stable. And,
but he's not talking to us because he has issues with his voice now?
Yes, he has a tracheostomy, and one is for speaking, and then he has the second one that cleans. But he can't talk at the moment, but he has a bucket list and he's stable. Like the doctor said, they called us in about a month ago, and it's just a bit emotional case for me.
I know.
We weren't expecting it.
So this is quite recent that you got the final word really on his prognosis.
Yeah, it's about a month ago, and they said that he would have, well, for starters, like my son works, he's a nurse in the ICU in Vincent, and the professor who was dealing with my brother is a colleague of his, and he asked my son, and I'm Will's next of kin, that we met in the conference room at 3 o'clock on Tuesday about a month ago. And we knew it was going to be bad news because, I mean, they're meeting in the conference room. They're not. If it's good news to tell, he can tell you anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
But we just didn't see the gravity of the news.
And are you going to be... Yeah, go on.
So they said he had two months to 10 months left, possibly, you know. He said a year, he's very, very, very lucky. And I felt it for the man delivering the news himself, because for my brother and him, you know, they were linked for that time. It was horrendous. I felt it, like I said, for him delivering it up on my brother's evening. But he said about compiling a bit of a bucket list, things to do before he passes on. And we're trying to make them happen as best we can.
Now just explain to me, for how many of you are in the family, Jonathan?
So there are five boys in total. Will is the youngest and I am the second oldest.
Right.
So, but I'd be possibly one of his closest brothers, if not the closest.
So he's a friend as well as just as your brother.
Oh, he's my best friend.
Yeah. So it's...
Yeah.
This is all very, very difficult, Jonathan, I know. But as you say, so what kind of... would he be a positive person anyway, William?
No, very, very much. Very, very much. And he'd be very outgoing and he's a very funny lad and he's very receptive of the situation and accepting of the situation that's happening at this moment, you know. Right. And he'd be a spiritual person. He sees, like we spoke about it, he said, I'm not afraid of dying. He said, I'm just moving to somewhere different, you know.
Yeah.
But he asked me to help him compile a bucket list and I've tried to do it. Now, my wife rolled out the letter to Lifeline, thank goodness, because I'm not really in great shape to do anything. And in the list, we're making all the things happen. We're funding all the things happening. But in the bucket list, there's a trip to the US and where we're having the difficulty. And the reason my wife contacted was because of the insurance issues.
Yeah, and just to explain, because I have your wife's letter in front of me here, the reason that William put this trip on his bucket list, it's not just to go to the US, it's for a very special reason. It's to see Billy Joel.
Yeah, that's right, in Madison Square Gardens,
Okay, so this is the trip of a lifetime, really. It's something literally a trip of a lifetime. It's the main thing in his, but one of the main things in his bucket list, and you can finance it as his family.
Very much.
Yeah, that's not the problem.
No,
it's travel insurance.
Travel insurance for someone who's terminally ill, it's not, Katie, a great conversation to have on air or with anyone. But who wants to talk about bringing a body back from somewhere? But that, unfortunately, is the reality.
So you're saying you basically have to get cover in case something happens while Williams is in the US?
Well, if possible. Now, I spoke to my son. Like I said, he's in ICU in St. Vincent's. And he said the chances of something happening to him are remotely very, very slim. Because he's relatively well for somebody with terminal cancer. He's stable at this point and he has this tracheostomy to breathe. So, and he looked up the barometric pressure about travelling in an aircraft and all of these things. We've exercised all the problematic situations. And in fact, he doesn't see a problem happening. But as we know, if a problem happens medically in the US, it's not like in Europe. You'd have to sell your house.
Jonathan Smith talking to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline about his brother William and their attempts to fulfil his bucket list requests. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, what makes a one-hit wonder? And why can't the artists involved make lightning strike twice? Simon Marr joined Claire Byrne to delve into the phenomenon of the one-hit wonder.
In general, though, how do musicians feel about being described as a one-hit wonder, hit makers?
None of them like it, as far as I can see. And a lot of them, what they're worried about is they say, well, maybe I'm a one-hit wonder now, but my next single is going to be the big one. And I suppose as a musician, you have to believe that as well. You have to think that the next big thing is coming along. So nobody's going to like being described as it. But maybe as you get older, then you kind of realise, I'm actually going to own this. I love this. I may have had just my 15 minutes of fame, but wow, they were good minutes.
Mm-hmm. What does it take to make a great one?
It's got to be a catchy single. So musically, it's got to be good. The lyrics, the vocal, all of that have to be good. What really helps is if it's kind of zeitgeisty, if it's something of the moment. And that can be something as simple as being a song from a movie, or it can be something like, you know, you got into an ad, or it can be something that was featured in a TV show, or just something that made it. Nowadays, it's, you know, that you've got a something that has gone viral on TikTok. That's how you do it now. You know, you get there and it can be some ridiculous dance or something that people just like at this moment, and it becomes huge.
Yeah, instantly identifiable. Absolutely. After the first couple of notes and so on. Well, we'll talk now about some of the musicians who happily pumped out catchy one-hit wonders, including this one. Prepare yourself, you know it's a must. Gonna have a friend in Jesus. So you know that when you die, he's gonna recommend you to the spirit in the sky. See, we all know that.
Absolutely. And everybody knows it. And Norman Greenbaum, the guy who wrote it, said he wrote it in 15 minutes. He couldn't work out. He was just curious more than anything else as to know, how do country music singers belt out these songs? They get them, you know, my pickup truck's broken down, mm-hmm. my wife's left me, my dog's dead. You know, how do they do this? And he said he wanted to write a song.
And did he perform that as well?
So he wrote and performed that song. It sold 2 million copies. Mm-hmm. And he's an interesting one because he said after that, he didn't care anymore. He was really scratching a creative itch with it. And once he worked out, this is how you do it. And then obviously enough, sold 2 million copies. He was perfectly happy and still performs and still plays to this day.
Right, because I mean, I recognise the song straight away, but I wouldn't know him now if he walked into this studio. Norman Greenbaum?
And he wouldn't mind. And that's the great thing about him. So he's very comfortable with this whole idea.
Now, Chesney Hawkes was almost the first name that popped into my mind when I was thinking about one-hit wonders. It's really difficult to get past this, isn't it? He doesn't like being considered a one-hit wonder, am I right?
He doesn't. He says, look, that was a thing in his life. So that was his zeitgeist moment. Mm-hmm. He got a gig acting in a film called Buddy Song, but I think Roger Daltrey was the baddie in it. And as far as he was concerned, they needed to get somebody to write the song. They got Nick Kershaw, who would have been huge at the time, to write the song for him. You can hear him singing there on the chorus. He got the song and he says, this is just something that elevated me. This got me all the musical gigs I wanted. It's got me more acting gigs, and it means I can still perform. And he's just released a box set of his 5 recorded albums recently. So he's happy with this, but he says, I'm just not a one-hit wonder because I don't want to be identified as that.
Okay, because he's done lots of other things.
Exactly.
Musical theatre and reality TV.
Yeah, oh yes.
Because of the one hit. Anyway, we won't say that to him. We won't say it too loudly. Now we come to the first song played on MTV. Tell me all about that one. I'm surprised that's a one-hit wonder.
Yeah, and nobody had heard of Buggles. Now, Trevor Horn, who is the man behind Buggles, went on to be a huge producer. He produced Frankie Goes to Hollywood, so Relax and Two Tribes, and all of that stuff was him. Went on, he produced albums for The Frames in Ireland, all sorts. So, massive, massive producer. But they recorded Buggles. They recorded a video, Kill the Radio Star, and another track called L Street. And they were sort of like tributes to a particular time in the film business and in the music business. And then MTV picked up on Video Kill the Radio Star, and suddenly it went huge. 16 mm-hmm. countries it went to number one in, and everybody loved it. And it still gets brought out now. But nobody, if you ask anybody, you know, do you have a Buggles album or do you have the Buggles follow-up? They'd go, no, there
again,
was a follow-up.
Like Norman, I would have said to you, I know that song very well, but Buggles... Never heard of Buggles.
No, and nor did most people, but either before or after Video Killed the Radio Star. Mm-hmm. But Trevor Horn was delighted. If for him, that was his calling card. He was able to then go and kind of go, okay, now I'm a big producer. This is what I do. He went off and he started ZTT Records, and it's gone on for him since.
Stratospheric from there. You mentioned that occasionally you'll have a song used in an ad and that propels it to one-hit wonder fame, like this one. coming back to me now. It was a Levi's ad.
It was a Levi's ad. And at the time, that was the thing you needed to get. There was all the 501 commercials with poor old Nick Heyman and everybody in them. And the stonewashed jeans, heard it through the grapevine, all of that. So they'd used a lot of 60s related tunes. But then they said, wonder, are we powerful enough to break a band to be able to do something? So that's where they came along to Babylon Zoo, Spaceman. And this was the thing, is can we actually not just revive a song that people already kind of know in their head, but can we introduce people to a brand new song? And that's what they did with Spaceman. And it became the biggest selling debut single ever. It was absolutely huge. And obviously sold a huge amount of jeans as well. But it was great for Babylon Zoo. It was great for Levi's. But then nothing.
Not a peep.
Absolutely not a peep out of them. Now, in fairness to Babylon Zoo, Spaceman, it should be pointed out that, like some one-hit wonders, it's not very good. But it was so much of the moment that it was huge just then. But once it burned out, that was it, gone.
Yeah. I mean, it takes you into the moment, but it's not great.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Now, soap stars, particularly those soap stars from Australia, they had many hits, not one-hit wonders per se. This one, though, arguably was a one-hit wonder. Let's have a listen. That's what's going on. Nothing's fine, I'm torn. I'm all out of faith. This is how I feel. I'm cold and I am shamed. Lying naked on the floor. That was a great song.
It was.
Natalie Imbruglia. Was that really a one-hit wonder?
See, she would say, again, she would be very determined that she's not. She said, first of all, Left of the Middle, which is the album that it was taken off, sold 7 million copies. And she sold probably 2 or 3 million albums since. You know, so she's still quite a big star, you know. She, again, got her all the acting. She won The Masked Singer last year. She was a panda. So that's actually, that's what she did. But would still be very, very popular. But
I wonder, has Chesney Hawkes been in The Masked Singer?
I think he did MasterChef and The Games. Oh yeah, this is how you keep the fame going. But it, again, it has the benefit that it's instantly recognisable. You hear it everywhere. And despite it being 20 odd years old, almost 30 years old now, you know, it's still a good single. And that's the thing.
Is that fair now to put her in the one-hit wonder gang, do you think?
She would say no. And given that she sold 7 million copies, who are we to argue, Claire? Mm-hmm. Who are we to argue with that?
Who indeed? That's 8radio.com's Simon Marr talking one-hit wonders, or not, with Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there's another Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. But for me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.